If you enjoy The Spectator's podcast, why not subscribe to the magazine as well? You can get 12 weeks of The Spectator for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher if you go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. This is a podcast-only deal, and we hope you take us up on it.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Heal, and I'm joined today by Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, and Paul Goodman, the former editor of Conservative Home. Now, Fraser, the campaign's been going on about a week now. How do we think the Tories are doing, given they are still 20 points behind the polls?
Well, the Conservative campaign was a mystery to me from day one. Like, why would he launch it against the advice of his own campaign chief, Isaac Levido? Why would he keep making blunder after blunder with the Titanic, etc.? And then the National Service threw me completely. Why would you have compulsion for teenagers as a vote winner? Why, where did this policy come from, given that they haven't discussed it in government? But then the pieces slowly came into shape. And I think the best example I can give, Katie Balls, I think, sums it up perfectly in her cover story this week. That what they've done is they thought, look, we're not going to win this election. But the reasonable outcome is between 200 MPs and 100 MPs. Now, right now, if today's opinion polls would become tomorrow's election results, according to electoral calculus, you would end up with just 92 Tories and 400-odd Labour MPs. Now, that would be a cataclysmic event. I was speaking to a former cabinet member who said it would mean that they'd be out for 10 years, 15 years, which, by the way, is quite plausible to a lot of Conservatives. Now, since this, I've been speaking to a great many Conservatives, as I imagine you have as well, Paul. And I've done a little test. I've sort of put the scenario to them and saying, look, in these circumstances, do we think that 200 seats would be a good outcome? Nobody has disagreed with me. Nobody has seriously tried to say, no, we think we can win this. And I think most people have accepted that there's a sliding scale between 100 seats, disaster, or 200, few, we just about survived. Now, if you're going to do that, you look at the demographics. Half of the voting public now is over the age of 65. So you basically just go for the pensioners. So this Conservative campaign is not a One Nation campaign. I don't think it's aimed at winning the election. It's aimed at losing less badly by keeping together as many pensioners, the only group likely to vote Conservative, by the way, more than Labour, as you can. So therefore you say, look, National Service, the younger layabouts, let's force them to do this. And by the way, we're going to give you tax cuts on your pension, so we're going to make you better off. There's a quote by David Cameron this morning, which took my breath away. It was quite, nobody picked up on it, but for me it was remarkable. He was saying, the Conservatives are always best for pensioners. Now, this is what I've suspected for a while. It's like you're saying the quiet bit out loud.
Yeah.
You know, I've written articles being critical of them being best for pensioners, but never good for young people, never good for working age people. And now they're pretty much posing as help the aged with the political wing, rather than a One Nation Conservative Party. But this makes sense when you see it through what Katie calls the 200-seat strategy, or what James Kangasoran, the pollster, describes as the Dunkirk strategy, when you've worked out you're not going to win the war, but you want to evacuate as many people as you can.
Paul, I mean, this campaign has really been about sort of two halves so far. The first sort of couple of days were marred by different incidents, you know, the Titanic quarter that Fraser talked about, the fact it was called in the rain and sort of helped the obviously visual metaphors there. And then the last couple of days, actually, it's been about the Tories turning the fire on Labour, the Diane Abbott row, of course. And then perhaps in the last 24 hours, there's been this whole incident about VAT as well, and where, you know, the Conservatives have really tried to bounce Labour into saying we won't have any VAT rises if we got elected. How do you think the Conservative campaign is going?
There's a Dominic Cummings quote, or at least a quote ascribed to Dominic Cummings, which is, quote, do crazy, then there's a short word beginning with S and ending with T, and then the quote ends. And when the campaign started, and on the first announcement, it really did look as though there was no more to it than do crazy S blank blank T. But I agree with Fraser that the whole thing has come together in the way Katie described. I think at first, one's instinct was, why have they done this? They've made everyone tear up their diaries. They're not ready in terms of selection of candidates. Lots of Tory MPs don't like it. I think in addition to the reason Katie gave, which was get this done now before you get into really deep water over Rwanda in the courts, I think they thought only by calling an election can we possibly get a hearing. But the evidence so far from the polls is actually, it's not made very much difference. Now, there is a theory around, Fraser's just quoted James Canavasori, who we both know a bit, that the Tory vote is being underestimated in the polls a bit. Maybe that's true, but that Labour's distribution of votes cancels that out because it's more efficient. In sum, we've really yet to see that this Tory campaign, for all its slogans, for all its new policies, for all it putting Labour on the back foot over VAT, so far we've yet to see it really make any difference at all.
Fraser, Paul there talks about the over 65 vote and what's happening with pensioners, but also a key part of this is about reform, isn't it? How much do you think reform is going to eat into the Conservative vote share? Initially it seemed perhaps that Rishi Tice might struggle, but now Nigel Farage has been out very much publicly making the case for reform.
Well, this is the big question. We know that reform tends to get about 12% in the opinion polls. We also know that when it comes to real life elections, even the handful of council seats that chose to fight in the locals a few weeks ago, it does considerably worse. So if reform were to get 12 to 15%, that would take a big chunk out of a Tory vote and might make it closer to 100 votes than 200. But it seems now as if the enemy the Tories are fighting for the over 65s isn't really Labour, it's reform. Mm. So that's why you are getting this national service thing. You're getting the sort of the patriotic drumbeat is being attempted here. And I think, of course, this is the only strategic advantage to an early election is that you have one before reform are really ready. Because right now, to win an election, you need canvassers, you need get-out-the-vote operation, you need a certain apparatus, which reform has not really had the chance to develop. It's mainly an opinion poll phenomenon at the moment. So I think there's a reasonable chance of reform being a bit of a souffle when it comes down to the general election, as, by the way, Nigel Farage was in 2015, which allowed the bigger Tory majority. So when the Tories tend to do well, it's because the polls have overstated the Farage-Tice aspect, and that more of that vote folds into the Tory camp and the actual ballots than you would expect. But Tice has been he has been quite busy, quite energetic. I think it's striking that Nigel Farage didn't stand, though, because I don't think he would have stood anywhere he thought he would lose. The fact that he's decided, and basically wrote this incredibly, if you ask me, arrogant letter saying, sorry, I've got bigger fish to fry in America. This is the guy who presents himself as the great British bulldog. If he'd have thought he could have won any single seat in the UK, he probably would have stood in it. So his decision not to stand suggests that Reform genuinely believe that they might get 10, 12% of the vote, but they're not going to get a single seat. The Lib Dems, by the way, will get a smaller share of that vote, but probably about 30 to 40 seats. That's the projection anyway in the moment.
Paul, Fraser there talks about Reform being sort of blindsided by this announcement. You've mentioned previously candidate selection. How do you think that is going? I wrote a blog at the beginning of the week talking about how, you know, the Conservatives had to select a candidate every 100 minutes to get enough, 160, I think, that needs to fill by next Thursday. What is your sense, perhaps? You've written previously, when you entered the Conservative home, about what was going on in terms of candidates being selected. The next sort of 10 days or so, now actually just 7 days, how do you think that's going to go in terms of who's going to be selected? Will it be about parachutes for the kind of minority which are safe still? And what about those kind of so-called quote-unquote paper candidates where it's more difficult?
Well, first of all, you've got a tranche of the safer seats coming up, if you can describe any Conservative seat in this election as safe. So sort of Daventry's, the Surrey Heaths, from which Michael Gove's just gone, and so on. So what happens at this stage is this. Whereas, as I understand it, under Labour, you can just impose a candidate. The NEC can simply do that. Yeah. With the Tories, there's a mite more democracy, though not much, which is that at this stage you're in what are called by-election rules. So effectively, the association is presented with three people. Now, I've no doubt at all that Downing Street and CCHQ will want to see some of their favourite candidates, no names, no pack drill, selected. But there is a catch, which is that they probably won't want to see them up against each other. They'll want to see them up against two, in their view, weaker candidates. But you can't guarantee anything with local associations. And the general trend over time, and particularly in these selections in this Parliament, has been to go local. The distrust Tory members feel, I'm afraid, in the government and the bruising that they've had from the Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak leadership election experience means they have gone in a lot of cases for people with local credentials, sometimes local councillors. So you've got to watch for some of the big names going up against what are apparently smaller fry, but not necessarily winning.
Fraser, Paul there talks about distrust in politics. And, you know, we've talked enough about the Conservatives mistakes in this election so far. Last 24, 48 hours or so, it's all been about Labour and what's been happening. Before we started this podcast, we were talking about how Angela Rayner has now intervened just a few hours after Darren Jones said he wasn't going to comment on the Diane Abbott situation. We've now got a shadow cabinet split on what's happened with the Diane Abbott deselection. What do you think Angela Rayner's game is here? And what do you think kind of the next 4 weeks are going to look like if Labour can't get its house together on issues like this?
Well, it's a good question. I'm reminded of that scene in The Godfather right at the end where Corleone says, like, tonight I settle all my family business. And this is what Keir Starmer is doing. All of his enemies are just disappearing. Whack, 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 whack. And he is... So Diane Abbott has always been in this difficult list. Now, as I understand it, Starmer has always been fascinated by the emergence of the Squad in America. These are the AOC and others who... There's a newly elected congresswoman in 2018, no stature, no power, but somehow, out of nowhere, they become hugely influential and they're able to start running candidates against the Democratic leadership. Now, how is this? By what alchemy does this happen? So Starmer's looked at this and thinking, well, when a left-wing party does well, this is the real opposition. It's not really the right-wingers. It's the guys from the harder left who will come after you. And even if you put them in no position at all, they can still, by dint of it, do it themselves. So I think he's working out who can be potential troublemakers and just zapping them. So we're seeing that at the moment. And of course there is uproar over Diane Abbott because she's an icon for the Labour Party. She's the first black Labour, first black MP, let alone Labour MP. She's got reporters hanging in the House of Commons. And she has got a big fan base. And I actually am going to defend Angela Rayner here. All Rayner has said is she can't see a reason why she shouldn't be an MP. Now, of course, that is not exactly no commenting, but it doesn't mean, I don't think, if Diane Abbott does apply and her application doesn't succeed in the end, as I doubt it will, if Angela Rayner would say, look, this has been a stitch-up, that would be disloyal. All she's saying is, yes, sure, she can apply. I can see circumstances where Keir Starmer might say exactly the same. I can't see any reason why she shouldn't be. But the way that he operates is all through the back channels. He's like the kind of golem of these back channels. He knows completely. He wins arguments and debates, Keir Starmer, not by open disputes, but by changing the system and tweaking the rules so that his opponents either find a trapdoor opens underneath them or a barricade is blocking their way. And in this way, he has used these methods to transform the Labour Party from the steaming mess it was in 2019, so after Corbyn, into now a seemingly unstoppable election force. So I mean no disparagement or disrespect to Keir Starmer when I say that he is the golem of these procedures, that he has done an incredible job rooting out and draining the Corbynist faction from the Labour Party. And I think he is showing that he's ruthless. And look at John McDonnell. He's as completely well-behaved now because he knows if he gives Starmer the slightest provocation, that'll be him gone as well. So McDonnell's saying, look, let's send F-16s to Ukraine. You know, the polar opposite. Nobody kicked off when Jeremy Corbyn left. So what we're seeing now is, I just think, the final stages of the Keir Starmer cleanup project, where he is wisely, in my view, taking steps to make sure that when he gets to Parliament, all the most obvious troublemakers have been dealt with before they got to the ballot box.
Paul, Fraser there talks about a Labour cleanup operation. You've actually served in the parliamentary party. What do you make of all this? How important is internal dissent? Or actually, you know, I know you're a friend of the Labour Party, but is it actually probably a good thing that Keir Starmer, from his own point of view, is getting rid of these people?
Of course, I never served under Starmerite discipline. And Fraser's just painted a picture of this as kind of sort of golem, almost death of Stalin sort of apparatchik, quietly pulling the strings and the levers and pushing the buttons. But I think there's another...
Do you disagree, Paul?
Well, I think there's another element to it. I think he's up against time because he knows that he's never surely going to be more powerful within the Labour Party than now in the run-up to an election.
With a 20-point lead,
With a 20-point lead, master of all he surveys, the left doesn't want to cause him any trouble yet. He knows the moment he's Prime Minister, the manoeuvring begins. Labour ministers and MPs begin to think, the left's still there, it's making a lot of noise, it's beginning to make its presence felt. I'd better manoeuvre a bit and leave myself some room open. It won't be long before the first Labour MP gets up in Parliament and says, I wasn't elected as a Labour MP to follow Tory policies. That's going to happen within the first 6 months, arguably within the first 6 weeks. So Keir Starmer, I don't disagree, but he's got to get a move on and do this stuff now. And of course, with the exception of the Abbott business, which isn't resolved, all this other stuff of making him look like this kind of monster, that's great. That's exactly the image he wants to project to these floating voters in provincial constituencies in England, that he's going to be really tough and hammer the left, so he's going to get on with it while he's still got time.
But I'm struck, Paul, the way that, as you say, he's got all this power. Now, he could use this power if he wants to seek a democratic mandate for welfare reform, for example. That he, in my view, he will have to reform welfare. It'll be very difficult. His party won't like it. Now, under our convention, our democracy, if you put something in the manifesto, the House of Lords won't block it as a part of the Salisbury Convention. So if you like, he's got this magic lamp which he can rub to get like as many wishes as he wants right now. So he can say, I'd like to do welfare reform. I'd like to other little things, which if he then faces opposition, he can say, look, we were all elected on a platform to do X, Y, and Z. So it could be a very effective management tool. Now, I just noticed that he doesn't seem to have any... Instead of rubbing this lamp, he's using it to pour boiling oil over his enemies. And I wonder if he'll come to regret that, or maybe he just doesn't intend to do the reforms, which I perhaps wrongly think he's going to be shoved into.
He's not a sort of Frank Field type of politician. They are rare, who are driven by ideas and doing things. He's a classic, not very mysterious, not very hard to understand, power politician. And, you know, he moves gradually and deliberately in phases to get what he wants. What does he want? He wants to win the election. And the really interesting thing about it is that I suppose, as a Tory, I mean, you should be warning people that we're about to experience the most left-wing government in history. We've actually got no idea what he's going to do. What we do know is that every promise he's ever made, all the leadership promises he made in his leadership election, he's not kept. He was, described Jeremy Corbyn as his friend and all that. And my worry about him, it isn't exactly that he's going to be a sort of classic left-winger, although I suspect that he probably will. It's we've no idea what he's going to do with power once he's got it.
Right, but he will have to row back on, for example, his net zero pledge. This decarbonising by 2030 simply can't be done. Now look at what happened to Hamza Yousaf when he wrote a row back on net zero pledge. So there are things right now which I think Starmer should be seeking a democratic mandate for, because he's in such a good position. But when he looks at the Tories, they're not fighting him, not really. They're adopting the brace position rather than preparing for any kind of landing.
I suppose you need some money for reform, and his programme has been ruthlessly closed down any prospect of spending more than the Tories.
So you need
doing very much with tax. So I suspect all he's going to be able to do is to give the left some stuff on the culture side, which is very much not reforming welfare or reforming health. I've always thought it's more likely a Labour government will reform those things in a crisis. You have to have a crisis to have the reform. There's no way he's going to do that unless the crisis actually happens.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, Paul. And thank you for listening to Coffee Hour Shots.